My good friend Walter Reuther tells me they can't pay me time and a half for overtime, therefore I rang the gavel. Thank you, Pat. Thank you very much, Pat Greyhouse, for a most friendly and warm and much appreciated introduction. President Reuther, officers of the UAW, the delegates to this great convention, their guests and their friends. You'll just never know how happy I am to have the chance to be with you today. I should tell you that I was met earlier this morning over at Philadelphia by Harvey Kitzman and Marshall Hughes and Ferdinand Clark. And they also had a state trooper over there. I wasn't quite sure why. I couldn't recall anything within the recent 24 hours that I'd done that necessitated any sort of law enforcement action. But he was a great help to us. I think you'd be interested in knowing that we made a rather rapid journey to Atlantic City. In fact, it was so fast that my friend Harvey Kitzman reminded the driver that he'd rather be Harvey Kitzman late than the late Harvey Kitzman. So we got here in good health. I was greeted here on my arrival by a very good friend of mine from Wisconsin, another good friend whom I addressed as, "Hello, Sam," my friend Sam Rizzo, who, by the way, one of your international representatives, has had the courage and those fearless qualities to become a chairman of a committee for a fellow by the name of Humphrey over in Wisconsin. And I'm mighty proud to have an international representative of the UAW in my working in my behalf. But I got to tell you what I said to Sam. I said, "Sam," I said, "are you taking good care of my interests? I said, Sam, have you been taking good care of my interests out in Wisconsin?" I said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "Listen, Humphrey, I'm here trying to take care of some of your interests around here, and you need help." Now, having said that, I raised his pay. He's getting twice as much as he got before, which is just twice as much as he didn't have before he started. And then I was greeted in just a moment by a whole wonderful delegation from Minnesota. And I'm particularly pleased that my old friend Ed Murnan was present. Ed and I have been soldiers in the cause of trade unionism and liberal democracy for a long time. And Ed was right there to extend the welcoming hand and to assure me that if I was on good behavior today and could square myself on several counts, that they'd let me come back to Minnesota without a passport. And I want to thank every delegate here from Minnesota, from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, from Hopkins, from Chisholm and Hibbing, from Austin and Winona, and all other parts of our state. And I might say to the delegates, if you haven't met these Minnesotans, you ought to look them up, because we're proud in Minnesota of the UAW, and it's better than 4,500 members in our state. Now, I know that you've had a lot of other speakers here, and I know you extended some invitations that were not readily honored. I understand that one of your speakers, or one of those requested to speak, was none other than the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Nixon. And Mr. Nixon, I understand, informed the committee that because of previous commitments, he was unable to attend and explain the presidential vetoes. I think you'd be interested to know that it was a very important engagement. He's winging his way to Miami right now, where he'll explain the vetoes on hole 18 at Indian Tree Golf Course. I'm sorry, I didn't mean Indian tree, I meant Indian spring. I get burning tree mixed up, you see. It's kind of difficult. I know you've heard two great Democrats speak here, two great United States senators, both of them friends of labor, and both of them fine public servants. The only thing that I can suggest that would be better is if you'll stick around long enough to hear a third Democrat speak. And I don't know whether that'll be better, but it'll be something in addition. You know, not long ago, we had a little confab in the Senate. And just so happened that my friend Jack Kennedy and Stu Symington was standing there in the hallway, and I walked up and visited with them a little while, and pretty soon another senator, the majority leader, came on up, Senator Johnson, and started talking to us. And Jack Kennedy said, he looked over at Stu and at Hubert, and he said, "I'll tell you, fellas," he said, "you know, I had the darndest experience last night." He said, I had a wonderful dream. He said, "I dreamed that the good Lord came down and put his hand on my shoulder and said, 'Jack, my boy, you're going to get the nomination and you're going to be elected.'" And Stu said, "You did?" Well, he said, "That's funny." He said, "I had a dream last night and it seemed like God came down and put his hand on me and said, 'Son Stu, I have good news for you.' He said, 'It's been a little difficult, but you're going to get the nomination, and when you get it, you're going to be elected.'" And I looked at those two fellows and I said, "You know, fellas, it's a peculiar thing. This is a coincidence of coincidences." I said, "Why, last night I had a dream. And I dreamed that God came down and he said, 'Hubert, you've suffered a great deal. You've been low man on that totem pole for months. But don't you worry, things are going to work out all right for you. You're going to get the nomination and you're going to be elected.'" And all at once, that big Texan leaned back and says, "I don't remember saying a word to any of you three fellas." Well, you can see what we go through in Congress. And we have quite a time around there. But I have a sneaking suspicion that when it's all said and done, that it'll be men and women like in this room, in this great convention hall, that will determine these important and fateful political decisions. You know, speaking to the UAW in conventions like old home week for me, I sometimes think it's so much like old home week that you folks know me almost too well. But I want to tell you, I always like to come back and refresh my acquaintance with you. Many of us right up here on this platform, and those of you out here in this hall, were present back in the 1948 Democratic Convention when we nailed to the mast of the Democratic Party a civil rights plank in the platform that was worthy of a great political party and a great nation. That was a test of liberalism. And I think a test, may I add, of political courage for all of us. And many of you were in the crucial and at times unbelievably difficult struggles in that period called McCarthyism. Struggles that are still going on to preserve civil liberties and freedom in America. Yes, in fact, the truth is that there are a lot of battle-scarred political veterans in this hall today that were in the liberal battles early, when you had to stand up and be counted, and when you were a marked man for many purposes, both in political and in economic life. And I can tell you, it seems mighty good to be back with those kind of folks. Mighty good. I'm ever indebted to your great president, the president of this international. I'm ever indebted to him for 1,000 reasons. But one particular reason in recent years is what he did for us in the last election. Now, I don't want to say that Walter Reuther won that last election, but I can tell you one thing, he didn't lose it. He was running... I traveled around in a number of states, and I kept looking on the ballot for the name Walter Reuther. Because every time I'd hear a Republican orator speak, he'd be talking about Reuther. "You're going to be voting for Reuther," this Republican orator would say. And I don't know, I'm a simple-minded sort of fellow. I'd get the ballot out and I'd look at it and I'd say, "Now, you know that poor Reuther, things are so hard up in the UAW they can't even afford to print his name on the ballot." But Walter, I want to tell you something, that the fact that the Republican reactionaries ran against you in 22 states and were defeated permitted a number of our good fellow Democrats to come in unscarred, unblemished, untarnished, unhurt. And we want to thank you for the diversionary tactics for drawing the fire of the enemy. Well, I suppose they'll be running against you, and I suppose they'll be running against Walter in 1962. I have a prediction to make. They'll do just about as well as they did in 1958, only a little worse. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about politics, as you could imagine. I've been keeping this a well-guarded secret. But I know you've had a great political action meeting. And I only wish that every union in America, I only wish that every liberal group in America had the political understanding, the political perception, and the political courage that has been demonstrated by this great international union throughout the years. You're a great one. My good friend Pat Grayhouse discussed with you in his introduction a little speech I made in the Senate entitled, "What's Right with Labor?" We'd had 3 years of people trying to tell us what was wrong with it, and they spent a good deal of time trying to find out something was wrong with the UAW. And the only thing that they could find that was wrong with the UAW was that the UAW was the kind of a trade union, the kind of an industrial union, the kind of a union that was an answer and is America's answer to the labor haters, to the crooks, and may I add, to the commies and the others too. If the American people want to know what's right with organized labor, I'll give them a good case example. I ask any objective group of students of labor management, I ask any objective group of scholars of political and social and economic action to study the history, the record, and the achievements of the United Automobile Workers, and they'll find out what's right with organized labor in America. I'll tell you what's right about it. Sound and effective collective bargaining, the finest type of collective bargaining, is represented by this union and its officers. Eternal vigilance. Yes, eternal vigilance for the economic and civil rights of every member of this great international is what's right with the UAW. Honest, fearless, and strong leadership and strong locals. This is what is represented by the UAW. And I'll add, a record of loyal and faithful dedication to this nation in peace and war, and to the principles of democracy and freedom throughout the world. That's what's right with the UAW. And I'll add finally, what the enemy knows to be right about the UAW, what the reactionaries in this country know to be right about this great organization, is its effective political action on election day everywhere in America. Now, my good friends, make no mistake about it, you've been the subject of careful scrutiny. Some people in and out of Congress have been taking a good look at you. They've had the political microscope on you. They've had the political Geiger counter out to see if they couldn't find a little malignancy here or there. But they have looked in vain. And now may I make a suggestion to you that after you've been looked over and worked over, why don't you reciprocate on some of those who were so generous to you? And if you're short of names, see me right after the meeting. I'll give you some. I realize a number of you in this great assemblage are a little bit unhappy about some of the developments in recent months, and you have a right to be. It is true that many times a representative body such as a Congress or a legislature can do unrepresentative things. But I want to say that the only answer that I know to better legislation, to more equitable and just legislation, to better government, the only answer I know is intelligent political action and persuasion, is electing more of your friends, not only for Congress, my friends, but in every legislature, in every state house, in every courthouse across the land. And make no mistake about it, and let's have it crystal clear, that no matter how well you may do for Congress, no matter how many of your friends you may elect to public office in Congress, until you are able to tie together both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, from Capitol Hill to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, from Congress to the White House, until you have friends in both jobs, you're not going to have the kind of an America that you deserve and want. There is not one thing, my dear friends, that's wrong with this country today that another good election can't cure. provided that the results of that election are not only a liberal, progressive, humanitarian Congress, but provided that in the White House you're able to place in that most important of all important positions in this world a man with the humanitarian compassion and dedication of a Franklin Roosevelt and the courage and the toughness and the fearlessness of a Harry Truman. Now, my friends, that's a big order. But these are difficult times, and we need to fulfill big orders and do big things, and all of us to do more than we ever dreamed was possible of doing. There are so many things that I should like to visit with you about today. It's been a long time since I've had this chance to see you. But let me just say this. I think every man and woman in this room knows that the year of 1960 is a year of decision for us. I think as a member of Congress that every one of us knows that we must perform, we must act in this second session of the 86th Congress. We Democrats, and I can speak now only as a Democrat, We have made promises to the American people. We have a platform. I support that platform. And I'm getting a little tired, may I add, of people who say they're Democrats not supporting that platform. A platform is a political party's contract with the electorate. And I believe in fulfilling contract obligations. Now, we can't expect too much from the conservatives. After all, they haven't even moved into today. They're not even sure about yesterday. It still may be. But at least for those of us that say we're of the 20th century, those of us who are supposed to be of liberal persuasion, we ought to look upon today as a challenge and accept the future with a great affirmative yes, that we're prepared to do our job. And there's lots of jobs to be done, and not the kind of jobs that are being done on some people. Your heart is heavy as is mine with the condition in certain areas of industrial relations in this country. Our friends of the steel workers, and by the way, if you haven't contributed, and I know you have, there's a box out there right at the door. And I'd like to solicit, before you leave this hall, a contribution from every delegate for those striking steel workers that need our help. The only way I know how to answer the green of Wall Street is a few sheets of green from working people. Now, my friends, you've been told about this strike, and I shan't take much of your time. I'll make my position manifestly clear, as it has been for weeks and months. This particular labor dispute, as it is termed, is not by accident. It is my conviction that the steel companies, after better than 6 months of heavy production and unbelievable profits, even in recession as well as in relatively full production, decided to have it out with a great union. And every worker in America is affected by this particular strike, because this is not just a dispute between the steel companies and the steel workers union. It is a testing ground, it is a battle between corporate power on the one hand, that has grown rich and fast and vested in its privilege in these recent years, and trade unions, industrial unions, who represent literally millions of working people and their families throughout this country. This is a showdown fight, and that's why it has been prolonged. The companies have not wanted to settle until they could place on the back of these working people the onus, the blame, for what I predict will be substantial price increases in steel, as they give pennies per hour to workers. And fellow Americans, when the government of the United States invokes Taft-Hartley, what you see is big government joining hands with big business, resulting in a big steal, STEAL, on the American people. Long ago, that fact-finding board should have been appointed Long ago, an objective fact-finding board should have made its report. Long ago, the American people should have known the facts. But from the very beginning, management, steel corporations have not wanted the American people to know the facts because they've been peddling misinformation. This is no secret to them as to how I feel. My governor in Minnesota talks to them this way too. We folks in Minnesota, where a lot of this iron ore comes from, know something about steel corporations. We've seen this battle before. And lest there be any doubt about it, let me just say this, that what America wants, that is what the rank and file, the great citizenry of this country wants and needs, is a fair and equitable settlement of this dispute. And it doesn't want to be propagandized into accepting substantial price increases by the steel companies and then having the charge of inflation laid upon the backs of the people who work in the mills and the mines and the shops of the steel corporations. But this has been coming for a long time, dear friends. A long time. I recall addressing this great convention back in 1953. I recall addressing this convention about what I thought were going to be the results of the 1952 election. I don't take back a single word of what I said. The only thing is, I'm ashamed that I had so little foresight. I took out the political shillelagh then, and I'm going to take it out again because there are some people that need a good spanking. And we're going to set the record straight. I said then that with the election of Mr. Eisenhower, one who hadn't made up his mind as to which party he belonged to for almost 60 years, that the Republican Party had elected one who was popular, who dazzled the public, who received a hero's response, and justly so. And I pointed out that he was like the canary in the gilded cage, placed in the parlor before the big picture window for all the passers-by to see and to stand and gaze in wonderment and joy. While back in the kitchen, the reactionary Republican crows were eating the public pie. And I repeat it. I was severely criticized then, and I imagine I will be now, for having made such a comparison. But I want to repeat it. Those Republican special privileged crows have been getting as big, my friends, not as crows, but as eagles, without, however, the same patriotic devotion. And what have they been doing? You want to know from whence our trouble stems? Let me make it clear. What were the first three acts of this administration? The first three things. Number one, they could hardly wait until they got into Washington to call to Washington, D.C., a meeting of the largest investment bankers and financiers to talk about what the Secretary of the Treasury insisted was an anti-inflation program. And what was their remedy? Higher interest on the public bonds, higher interest on public financing, higher interest rates all through the economy. Number one, George Humphrey, I'll have you know. George, not Hubert. And as you've heard me describe it before, neither George nor Hubert are related either biologically or politically, and we're both delighted over the circumstances. George, Republican Humphrey, is trickle-down George, and Hubert, Democrat Humphrey, is percolate-up Hubert. Now, that's the difference. Number one.